Hello and welcome to episode 99, imagine, of the Creighton Crowbar podcast. It's the 29th of June 2015. My name is Chris Thurston and today I'm joined by Marsh Davies.
Hello.
Graham Smith.
Hello.
And Tom Francis.
Hello.
On a beautiful, sunny day, we've trapped ourselves inside
In a dark room.
Which
will quickly smell of us.
To drink ale and talk video games.
To ruminate on the failures of our neighbours who've hounded us from our previous podding studio by hanging around outside the window having a lovely time outside. The
fucking arseholes.
Indeed. And this brooding place we find ourselves in is as good a segue as I'm going to get to talking once again about Batman Arkham Knight, because we spoke about it last week and our experiences playing it. Tom, you're still playing on PC. I've jumped ship to PS4 now. And there's a reason for that, which is they have now taken the completely unprecedented step of withdrawing the game from sale entirely. I can't think of another instance where this has happened. Can anyone else, like, as a starting point?
What did they do with Elemental? Didn't they do something strange like that? I think they made the expansion free for everybody.
Yeah, they certainly compensated for the terrible standard in which the game was released, but I don't think they actually took it off sale. I think there have been precedents before in Early Access. Wasn't there an Early Access zombie survival game which was taken off sale by Valve rather than by the developer?
Yeah, but that's in a different territory.
Was that what it was?
I think the War Z was pulled at some point.
Because the store page didn't make clear which features were yet in the game and which were someday going to be in the game.
Right.
And also there was originally controversy about its name because it was obviously following in the footsteps of DayZ quite closely. And it eventually did return, but it returned under a different name.
That's right, yeah. But yeah, no, it's a different ballpark. I can't think of an example where a AAA developer has voluntarily removed their own game from sale.
Just from Steam, but from retail stores apparently as well. Yeah. Even stranger.
Do we think it's because of the Steam refunds thing? Or is it just something they would have done anyway? Because it's also extremely unusual in that it seems like the extent of the problems is unusual as well. Like, it's a much worse port than their previous ones. Hmm. And I don't know about Warner Brothers, but Rocksteady are very exacting, it seems.
I imagine it was them who demanded it be taken
maybe.
On sale.
I wonder what
kind they have quite a lot of clout with Warner Brothers, I think, because they've made so many big hits for them.
Yeah, I wonder if that's true.
I mean, well, Arkham City was released in quite a shit state on PC. Like, it had really big performance issues when it came out, and it was fixed a few months later. Like, I think the thing that's interesting about this is not so much that it was pulled, but that it wasn't that unprecedented. Like, more broken games have been released.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Games like Fallout New Vegas was in quite
a bit. Well, this would be the normal state in which games were released 10 years ago on PC,
And so something has clearly changed that means that now a game, this is the step that a publisher takes. Because obviously, I mean, it feels like, you know, games are either late on PC to make them work, or they arrive day and date and they have problems, and Warner opted for the latter, but have now ended up going for the former, which is kind of weird. Like, no one's ever done both before.
The Steam Spy guy posted that he'd looked at the numbers of refunds that might have been processed for the PC version of Arkham Knight, and it was, I think it had to be at least 5,000. His numbers are always come with like a standard deviation of error. What's the word for that?
I don't know the term.
Yeah.
So it's this, but it's inaccurate to up to 10,009. It was something like the inaccuracy was very large, but also the figure was so large that it had to be at least 5,000 people returning it.
Wow.
And presumably that's, I guess actually it's quite a good time to be able to measure it because it's not being sold anymore. So the sales, the number of owners is not going up for any reason.
It's interesting, like, I wonder if a part of it was, there was that sort of kerfuffle about the NVIDIA 60 frames a second trailer that someone thought had been sped up.
Oh yeah.
Which was subsequently shown to, I don't know if you saw this, that there was an NVIDIA GameWorks trailer for the game showing off the PC exclusive effects. And then a part of it that was ostensibly running at 60 frames a second. It's amazing that I saw the trailer at the time, and it's amazing I didn't notice this, but the audio was running at double speed. So when Batman punches a guard, he goes, "Eh!"
Really?
Yeah, no. And you watch it back and it's completely audible. Like, he like fucking choke slams a guy into the ground and he goes, "Ah!" And it's like, and so there's this like, is this video just been sped up? Like, is this, you know?
Oh, I see. So do you think they're removed it from sale because they're afraid of false advertising?
Well, claims? So then someone else came along. This is on Reddit and NeoGAF. Someone else came along and pointed out that apparently the Unreal Engine has a forced render app function where you can get it to kind of output a demo at a forced frame rate, and it'll just spend however much time. It's probably quite common that developers use this for their trailers to get a smooth frame rate for videos. And apparently one thing that can come from this is audio bugs, because it might be, you know, operand, you know, the game. So it might not have been as shady as doubling the speed of a 30 frames per second video.
Right.
But obviously the game was advertised as 60 frames per second on PC a couple of months ago, and that is not possible with the game as it's released, or even as they advise. You can unlock the frame rate using any file, but they don't advise you to do that. So maybe they were worried about a kind of false advertising claim, given that that simply wasn't possible and had been advertised explicitly before, but it's kind of hard to speculate. But clearly they're more afraid of the PR and financial hit from releasing an unfinished game now than any publisher seems to have been in the past, where it's been fine.
Do you think it'd be good if consumers routinely took developers to task for unfinished games, in the sense that on the basis of false advertising? Because that would be produce a lot of issues in terms of being able to say what your game contained years in advance. Because there have been attempts to do this, haven't there? Class action lawsuits against games, which then, you know, I think maybe it was Bioshock one of them, where, or I forget now. A game was released in which the kind of early press for it stated that it was going to have a bunch of different features, and they never materialised.
Yeah,
but because of the natural nature of development, like they,
yeah. The only one I can think of was that I think there was a class action lawsuit against, was it Battlefield 3 or Battlefield 4 that came out in a maybe 4 that came out in a super buggy state, and it was EA where accused of knowing that it was going to be in a buggy state before it came out. In fact, I think partly they were taken to task over it by their own shareholders.
Oh, right.
Who, you know, because they took a hit on the stock market after it and didn't get the profit gains that they had said to their shareholders that they were going to. And so their own shareholders were like, well, you knew that this was in a buggy state, that it was going to get a negative reaction. Therefore, you misrepresented it when you at the annual meeting or whatever.
Certainly would suck if we got into a situation where everything you said about your game had to be true at release, no matter how early on you said it, you know, because that I couldn't do videos of my game anymore because I don't know anything. I haven't got any of these features. I can take any of these things out.
Be really bad news for pathological liars, that's for sure. But yeah, it's interesting. Like, and there's no ETA for it coming back either, which is kind of crazy. It could be, I mean, Steam page currently says autumn, but that seems to be to coincide with the launch of Steam boxes, and that message may have been there anyway.
I think Duncan Harris made a suggestion on Twitter. He suggested that it might come back, but as like a bundle with some DLC, so that they can call it some kind of, you know, Supreme Edition thing. Change its Steam store location and get a whole new load of Steam reviews, which are starting at a more...
Because you can do that. Like, I think the Arkham City Game of the Year Edition is a separate app on Steam, which means all of the reviews for the previous one don't count for this one. And also the old one's removed from Steam. Like, there's no way to get the non-Game of the Year Edition.
I don't think it would save it. I think the ill will towards that game is now so intense that, you know, I don't think it's going to not have...
Oh, people aren't going to forget this.
Yeah, no.
I just think that's probably what they're going
to
do, though.
Yeah, no, that seems very viable. It's interesting, like, it's because we, you know, PC Gamer cancelled our review because it's like, the purpose of a review is to act as a buyer's guide. If you can't buy something, then you can't review it. And we'd already produced like 3 articles about its problems, so didn't feel like it was any necessity. But a lot of people were really angry about that because there's this idea that a review is sort of like a form of consumer revenge. That the, you know, the bad score we would have had to give it
would be justice.
Yeah, it would be this form of justice. The 3 articles we produced about what a bad state it was in, that doesn't count. What counts is when the score is affected. So with that in mind, that reaction in mind, I can't see how even republishing it on Steam is ultimately going to save its Steam rating. Because people will go in there just because it was once bad. And, you know, we the people demand blood in the form of low numbers. What other news from the world of legal machinations we don't quite understand?
Yes, it's a very accurate way of describing it. The EU have just now, today, I'm not exactly sure of the kind of path their legislation takes through their bureaucracy, but there's like a preliminary part before something becomes law. I think it's going to get... It's been voted on enough that it's going to be presented to a committee that will then legislate. Anyway, it's a restriction on the degree of freedom you have. It's called Freedom of Panorama, which is a copyright law about being able to reproduce things in your surroundings, which will actually have huge repercussions for games, because lots of games reproduce the real world, like, you know, car games set in London, for example. And what this means is previously, in London anyway, in many EU countries, you would have no reason to not reproduce buildings that are in a public space. Mm. You could do that freely because they're considered public domain. But from now on, you'll have to get licenses from the people who own the buildings and every piece of street furniture and stuff that you include and try and replicate in your game. And even people who are taking selfies and publishing them on their blog, if they have advertising on their blog, they'll be considered to be making money from that, and they also have to seek the licenses at presumably at some cost. This is actually something that already exists in France. There's no freedom of panorama in France, which is why I remember interviewing Bizarre Creations when they still lived about one of their games, PGR, I think. I think it was either the reason that they didn't include any race course in Paris, or was just very expensive for them. I can't remember, but.
Why do the EU think this is desirable? Like, why?
Well, I haven't asked them, unfortunately. you can see why a case could be made for it for people who are idiots. you know, the protecting copyright, justly rewarding people who have some kind of sense of ownership over these things. I mean,
like, it's like if you don't feel a sense of ownership over your building without this law, maybe you should. Like, there's no incentive for me to make my building in any way good or attractive because I don't get any money if someone takes a photo of it.
Or a recreation of it or anything. I mean, you'd have to seek the licenses of graffiti artists as well. Who deface those buildings.
Luckily, they signed it.
I mean, this comes up before on smaller scales. Mm. Like, there was lots of controversy about the bean in Chicago, which is like a giant reflective bean that they built in a central square there. And they, at first, when it was first built, though it was built in a public park, there was like security guards that would try and stop you taking photos of it. Like, even if you were
not photographed the sky bean.
If you wanted a photo of the bean, then you had to get a postcard.
Is this still in Watch Dogs?
Yeah. Well, yes, it's in Watch Dogs, but it's not the same shape. They didn't create beans, so it's shape of like a pretzel. Basically.
This is unrelated.
Well, maybe they don't have the Freedom of Panorama in... Where is Watch Dogs at?
Chicago. So, but the rest of the city is the same. It's just this bean, as it's, I guess, a corporate work of art that's copyrighted, and they pursue that copyright. Then they create something which is representative. It's in the same spot in Chicago, but it's not the same thing.
Mental.
Yeah.
It seems completely untenable, doesn't it? Like, I mean, for selfies on a blog in particular, that's never going to actually be...
This is going to be the issue that gets Britain out of the EU, unfortunately.
Yeah.
In related, British law, in terms of, like, games and where they're set. So, you know, there's the UK tax breaks for game developers now, which is cool. You have to qualify as being... It has to be a British game, and you have to be a British developer. And there's an elaborate sort of questionnaire that gives you a certain number of points for having a certain number of British people on your team and things. So British people on your team gets you points. Being written in English gets you points. And it says being set in England gives you points. And then you look into like the description of what that means and how that breaks down. Like, how does that work for like? Fantasy Realms and Space, for example, which is where my game is set. And in the fine print, it specifies that anywhere that is not specifically a named other country counts as Britain. So space is
that British is now. That is how the Empire worked, yes.
you didn't claim it as your country. Then.
What's this called?
So Heat Signature is British game through and through. So good old British space.
It's weird. Because it's such a selling point. Yeah, you mentioned racing games earlier, particularly that they might be set in real race courses. And I assume those race courses themselves are already licensed. But what about the backdrops to those race courses?
Yeah.
Like, who owns the Alps, for example? Or...
Yeah, I think probably aspects of the natural geology are probably outside the remit of this law, but anything man-made, certainly.
Does this not completely fuck Google Maps?
Yeah, I don't know how that's going to work for Google Maps. So I suspect they already pay some kind of licensing
to everybody in every building.
Well, especially it's Google Earth or whatever, where they actually put down 3D models to represent it. And if not that, then just like Microsoft Flight Simulator and X-Plane, where you can fly over the entire world and they use satellite data, which they presumably license from a company that provides satellite data, but not from the owners of each individual building.
Tis a madness.
Isn't, in fact, something like this the source of the phrase Streisand effect?
Really?
Barbara Streisand had a picture of her house that was on, I think it was in some mapping or aerial photography, I don't know, magazine or something, and it was of a house, and she wanted them to know where her house was, and so she sued them for it, but no one had actually heard of this, wherever it was published, until she sued them, and that became a massive story, and so everyone saw the photo and knows exactly where her house is. And so the Streisand effect is when, by trying to suppress something, you bring undue attention to it.
How obvious was it, without her suing them, that it was Barbara Streisand's house? Like, there was a big picture of her in the garden? Or like
half mowed into the hedges.
Tom.
Yes.
What have you been playing?
I've been playing two games that we talked about both of last week, Batman and Her Story. Which of those should I talk about?
Well, several of us can talk about Her Story, but we can talk about
Her Story?
Okay. It's brilliant. Everything Tom S. said about it is correct. It's a brilliant detective game, and it gives you that feeling of, like, genuinely discovering truths about the case. So, to recap, it's a game in which you're just sat at a computer typing in search queries to find video clips. And all the video clips are of the same woman being interviewed by the police about the disappearance of her husband. And they're extremely short. So, some of them literally just, yes. She says yes in isolation. And some of them are more like, one of the first ones you get is her saying, "You think it's murder? Well, of course it's murder." And that's it. So, some of them are very short like that. The longest ones are like nearly 2 minutes, and by searching for them, by typing in words you think she might have said in some of them, you discover new ones. And so watching those gives you more ideas about what to search for and stuff. And the weird thing about it as a detective game is that the crime, or rather all of the truth you're ever going to get out of it, is already known by the police, because all you're searching is records of police interviews. So there's no actual... you're not really going to solve the case. I mean, you do... you end up with a pretty strong idea of what happened, and it's very clear to me, at least, that the intent of the game is that that is the truth, or at least, you know, there's a kind of definitive truth that the game's trying to communicate. But, of course, because literally everything you ever see or hear or anything, it all comes from this one woman where you're never going to hear the questions she's asked, you know, or what she's responding to. Of course, it doesn't have to be true. She could be anyone. It could have been, like, maybe no one was even killed. And there was never another person at all. And she's, like, a flasher who's been arrested for public streaking. And she's just making up random shit. And everything in between what you see is the police saying, "What? We didn't ask you that. What are you talking about?" So, but it kind of... the game is to uncover the truth as it appears to be from what she says. And, of course, that changes. And, of course, there's layers of complexity and deception to it. Discovering that is just a huge thrill, even though it's already been discovered. Like, I don't know about you guys, but for me, the fact that it was already all out there, and you know that from the start, like, you know you're not going to suddenly get access to something the police didn't have, still made it a really exciting process of discovery.
It's interesting because it's arguably one of the most spoilable games ever made. Like, you say the wrong word, and you give any sort of, and that's because the process of discovering things in it almost feels like spoiling it. Like when you kind of twig something and you start chasing down related words to the thing you've twigged.
Yeah.
You often get, you know, you sometimes get these, sometimes you get, okay, there's not much in here, but sometimes you get these kind of exponential increases in the amount you know.
Yeah.
And the paradigm shift that affects how you look at things you already knew and that kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah.
And because you can experience that stuff in any order, you know, there's no incorrect order, and that's one thing that's so clever about it, is there's no incorrect order to receive that information in, but it can sometimes feel like, oh, yeah, wow, that changes everything really quickly. To the extent that
you can cheat yourself out of exploring that narrative in a way which would feel more like discovery.
Mm.
Like, you can stumble across stuff and it'll, like, there are still revelations to be had, even if, like, I was talking to Matt Castle about this, our friend who's the editor of OXM, and he played it, and just by accident, one of the first three words that he searched got him to kind of, like, the crux of the story, and he wasn't searching words that were included in the clips he had just watched, but he just typed in words that he...
Aliens! Oh, shit!
But words that I'm surprised that the developer didn't look for and say, is this going to take somebody right to the end of this?
Yeah, so there's an interesting thing.
The ones you can type in which just...
So when you type in a word, you only get 5 results. And when I played it, I never really paid attention to what order they come up in. Because, of course, if you search for the word the, you find nearly everything that she's ever said, except you only get the first 5 results.
Yeah.
And its concept of what the first 5 are, it's not like Google where it tries to give you the most relevant thing. It does it chronologically. And I actually never noticed that my whole playthrough. Is only afterwards when I was coming to write about it that I thought, I should just check. Is there a logic to what it is? And it's always the earliest stuff. And that works as a pacing device for the most part, because the earliest interviews are the least revealing ones, because she's repeatedly interviewed by the police. And naturally, if anything's going to get revealed, it's going to get revealed towards the end of the interviews. So yeah, as they go on, they get more and more kind of juicy in terms of how much you learn from them. And so the fact that if you do search for the, you'll get 5 clips from the very first interview. And so you can watch all, and that you have not you've not demonstrated any insight by searching for the word the. And so you're rewarded by not getting that much information except the basics. And so that kind of holds true most of the time. But of course, there's, you know, the number of unique words mentioned in all these clips is going to be astronomical, and loads of them are going to be common. There'll be hundreds and hundreds of very common words that you don't need to know any insight to search for. And some combination of them will only be mentioned in the last few clips, and that will be, you know, a big reveal. Mm. But it's really interesting. I watched Kim play it, Kim of the Yogscast, and she got a series that you can actually see, like, she scheduled them all to go up, and so you can see it's, like, I think it's, like, 8 or 9 videos long, and the first one's 25 minutes. And I watched her play, and at the end of that first 25 minutes, she searches something and sees a clip that to me was like, oh, she's just got straight to the end of it. She knows everything now. And I thought, like, she would kind of lose interest after that point. And then, like, on the third episode, I saw her description of it, and it's like, I discover a chilling truth about the case. And actually watching the second one, even, I realized, like, she's got just that one part of it. And to me, that spoils everything, because that was one of the last things I came across, and I already knew everything else, so it fitted into the context of everything else I knew. But if you discover that in isolation, actually, you don't know that much. You know kind of one aspect of it, but there's so much more that it links into, so much more.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of twists along the way that you can go back and uncover, even if you've got the kind of final piece.
Yeah.
I had a good time with it. I really enjoyed it. But I think after like an hour or so, I got what was happening. And then I carried on playing, but it was kind of like my knowledge had plateaued at that point.
Yeah, this was in Andy Kelly's review for PC Gamer. I was surprised to learn from reading it that he kept searching until he found all of the clips.
Hmm.
And obviously I knew you could do that, but I got to a point where, I mean, there's these revelations and you go through many of them, but I got to a point where I was like, well, I know. I can't imagine there's much more to learn. As I was searching, and I did do common words, because I'd run out of all the things that I could possibly search for in terms of meaningful topics, so I was just scrounging for just anything, and then when I was finding clips, for me, it did reach a kind of, you know, like you say, a plateau where the things I'm learning are not interesting, because they plug into the other things I already know, but they're not big revelations anymore, and I felt like there probably aren't any more. And so I quit out and went into the games folder and found the folder where it stores all the videos.
Oh, really?
And they're all beautifully named in chronological order, so you can just like, sit down and just watch the entire thing. And the amazing thing is it's only about 90 minutes of footage.
Hmm.
So it's just the length of a movie, basically, a short movie. But it had taken me 2.5 hours to discover what I'd discovered. And when I quit out, I noticed I didn't even have the achievement of watching half the videos. So I'd seen less than half of them. And I went through and I just watched, particularly, I think the last two interviews, which are nearly half of the stuff, I watched all of them in chronological order straight through. And that's an amazing thing, because I was right that I hadn't missed anything major. But when you watch them in chronological order, that's totally different to seeing them out of order. Because even though I'd seen all the juicy ones and things I'd seen, but when you see them in order, you're like, oh, shit, she's talking about that.
So the actual clips do actually have some...
There's a relationship with each other, yeah.
Continuity between them.
Because yeah, so there's actually... So the ones I mentioned earlier, which is just saying yes or no.
Yeah.
I only know about those because I found them in the game files. I never would have searched for the word yes, and never would have searched for the word no. And even if I did, they wouldn't have come up because they were in the last... interview.
I've definitely seen some that look like they follow on from the previous other ones, but like yeah. I didn't know if they. I mean, they have no reason to necessarily keep that continuity.
So you do. You never hear the questions. So there's time missing. So sometimes you never find out what she was referring to. And the ones where she says yes or no, which is hooked up to a lie detector, and so you can just watch them in order, and they're just like yes, no, 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 yes. There's a clip afterwards. Those are all individual clips, like yeses and noes.
There's No, there is stuff that you wouldn't twig if you don't pay attention to the order the clips come in. Like, if you don't, like, I was writing down timestamps, basically, because it really is important. Like, or at least it was for where I am. Like, I don't know. There's a lot to be said for the fact that you don't necessarily know the whole thing until you've found almost all of it. That's Andy's experience, because Andy spent like 10 hours at it, I think. Like, because we got it quite early, I think. Because it's one of those games where once, obviously, it was done a while ago, I think, and then kind of polished for a while. I think Andy was the first person to ever max it out outside of the people who made it. So, it took him a long time, but he seemed to get a lot out of it. Like, I haven't finished it yet, so I haven't provided too much information. But from what he said, he didn't really feel like he'd finished it until he finished it.
Huh.
So, but I mean, I guess everyone sort of reacts differently to.
Yeah, I felt I did want to see it all. Like, I didn't stop because I wasn't curious about the rest of the clips. It was just because the search mechanism had got to the point where it was just kind of scraping the barrel. I was showing no insight. I wasn't having those moments of like, my insight led to this brilliant revelation and I feel good about that. It was just, can I get anything new? Is there anything new at all? And so at that point, if I just want to see all the new stuff, I should just go into the game files and watch all the new stuff. And I did.
It's interesting with the structural stuff, because my fear was that I would play it and wouldn't give myself over to it. I would do what I do in an RPG. If I start facing in a certain direction, the first thing I'll do is turn around and walk in the opposite direction just to see what the game designer has left behind me that they don't want me to see.
Fuck you!
And so I'm worried that in her story that I might ruin it for myself. So it's interesting to hear that that wasn't really your experience.
Well, it was Matt Castle's experience, Mike. But I mean, I think he was quite unlucky. Yeah,
I think I need to get further in it to understand the context for that, but like, I definitely had multiple moments where I've realised that I didn't understand clips I thought I understood at all.
Yeah, and an amazing thing where the first clip that really made me think, oh, I know what happened now. I kept on searching for stuff like an hour after that and kept on finding out new interesting information to developing my picture of what happened and found out loads of interesting stuff. And then I went back to check something in that original clip, and when I listened to it again, just every single part of it had a different meaning now. Like, all of it, some of it was just inverted. Like, what I thought was happening was actually the opposite was happening. And it's all just really cleverly worded. And there's another thing where a clip that doesn't tell you anything, really, that I watched quite late, and I knew something about it when I watched it and realised that what I knew was being communicated in every single line she says for like a minute and a bit, where it seems perfectly innocuous, but there's just something odd about what she's not saying that you'd never know. Well, maybe you would if you're more intuitive than me, but I think I'd seen it before I knew the truth. And when you watch it again, knowing the truth, you realize she's really, really cleverly avoiding ever saying anything about this specific thing. It's really hard to say any more about that.
I'll tell you what I'd really liked and also found oddly spooky about it is the way it's presented, because it's presented as though you're looking at a kind of old CRT screen, and but it's not actually just that, it's also the noises as well. So whenever you make a mouse click with your mouse, there's also click in the world. And it's like, it's got the kind of noise of an old mouse, and kind of when you type anything, you can hear a keyboard clattering, and somehow that is really creepy. I don't know what it was about, and occasionally you kind of hear somebody kind of creaking in their chair and coughing a bit, and they're like, that's like I'm, somebody's in my chair haunting me.
It's it reminded me of Gone Home in that way, and it has a lot of the atmosphere of a horror thing, like expecting something horrible to happen.
The buzz of kind of fluorescent lights flickering on and off. Mind you, in a deserted office.
One of the things I was wondering about it, though, is it's really interesting mechanically, in terms of this. It's all based around search. You basically just have a search engine as your main tool. And that only really works because it limits your results to 5, and so you can't get everything by searching for something easy. And I was trying to think, like, do you think that can be applied to other games? Is this like a genre that could exist? Because it's so much better than FMV games were, and it's so much better than most interactive stories.
I'd be totally happy if Sam Barlow decided to just make more mysteries exactly like this.
That's what I thought. Like, it's a really good system, but I don't know if you could recontextualize it and say, oh, for some completely different reason, you only get 5 results of and have a search engine-like interface. I feel like you almost have to stick with the exact same thing and say, you're using the same damn computer system to investigate this different thing.
It would be super cool, though, if it was like a 1980s Cold War spy sort of story. You were just, you know, that would justify the technology and the searching method, but it would be a significantly different genre that it would probably feel different.
I specifically said something to the effect of, I really like the system because it feels like the restrictions that I have in what I can and can't do they've matched the restrictions my character faces in the fictional world, because my character's sitting at a computer with his computer system. And somebody commented to say that actually they felt the opposite and that it kind of ruined it for them because they felt the 5 results thing was so artificial. And that's true, it is a really weird restriction. But I was thinking, like, why do I find that just natural? And I realised it's because actually using a highly sophisticated computer system that has a bizarre arbitrary limit to it is just my default state. That's what I do every day. Everything I use is frustratingly awkward and obtuse in some stupid way. So this just makes perfect sense to me.
I really liked Digital Love Story, which does something similar in that it's set on kind of very early 90s BBS, where you're using a very old-fashioned computer system and then dialing in with a 28.8k modem in order to browse emails, and that's how you explore the plot, is exploring this archive of emails. It's just...
I definitely think it's got lessons to teach, about the just liberties you can take that I think conventional wisdom is that you can't give the player a way to discover the final piece of the plot right at the start. Right? You have to, even if you don't tell it in chronological order, you have to control the order the player discovers things in. Otherwise, they might spoil it for themselves, which, you know, sounds like Matt feels he did. But it also seems like for the vast majority of people, it's worked out really well. Like, even Matt Lee's tweeted about finding the secret really early on, but then he tweeted again today to say it was still like an amazing, brilliant experience and wholeheartedly recommend it, and it still was gripped right to the end. And so I think feel like one of the lessons to learn is that if your plot is complex enough and you split it into small enough chunks, then you can just let the player find those in whatever order they want to.
It's interesting because the reason it's so impressive as a thing is not, unlike a lot of games, that it's technically impressive. You know, the presentation's great and so on, but the act of writing it is fucking mind-boggling. Like, how you write something that tight where there's really... Because what you're doing is searching for words, you really can't ever get a word too far out of place. Like, it has to be perfect, and it pretty much is. Like, for the amount that, as you say, like, the amount of double entendre that sort of parts of it conceals and things you can go back and rediscover about particular stretches of time in those videos where it's like, oh, this is not what I thought it was, that kind of thing. Like, it's kind of nuts how planned it is. You know,
it'd be interesting to ask actually, like, how much revision that required. I mean, as in iteration. Like, whether you had to keep going back and changing things so you realised, oh, this common word you might search for totally ruins too much or something, or whether it was all fell into play quite naturally. I don't know. One thing, so very early on in it, because it's a detective-y game and it's about solving this case, I was, for some reason I was just really, really switched onto it right away. I was just so into it the moment it started. And just from watching the first 4 clips they give you, was trying to deduce everything I possibly could from those and writing down all the dates and taking copious notes. And I went a bit too far and got... I chased a red herring, which I'll tell you about because I actually know for sure that it's not a thing you should investigate.
Well, if you still say it specifically, then it's kind of...
It's literally like a mistake in the game. The dates don't match up to real-life dates, basically. So I was obsessed with this idea that she's... references a Saturday, and I'm looking at the date of the interview.
Oh, I see.
And it's like, that can't have been 2 days ago, because the Saturday in 1984, that thing was a Sunday, so you can't, Saturday can't have been the day after.
Oh, I see.
And so eventually I emailed the guy and said, look, I might just bark out the wrong tree here, because, like, if she's lying, it's just such a weird lie. You should immediately know she was lying about. And apparently, it's actually not a mistake, technically, but it's, he did it intentionally because he was worried that the real police might think that it was based on real events or something.
No way.
So he put in like intentional mistakes like that.
Huh. You've been playing a detective game as well, haven't you, Graham?
I have. Because I'm stubborn and everyone was telling me to play Her Story, I decided to play a game called Black Closet, which is a game by, I think it's Hanako Games, who predominantly make visual novels with anime art styles, but most of their games pair that stuff, which aren't things that I'd normally be a fan of, with resource systems and high difficulty and a lot of management stuff. And they did a game a couple of years ago called Long Live the Queen, which I think we discussed on the podcast, where you are a young princess is about to become queen, trying to survive long enough to actually ascend to the throne. And it's this kind of choose-your-own-adventure thing, but what's interesting about it is that every day you decide which skills you're going to learn, and the skills that you learn decide whether your character is good enough in order to pass the life-threatening situation that's going to befall them. And it's really fun and entertaining because of how much it branches and the wild situations it leads to. And it's sort of frustrating for the same reason, in that it's a lot of trial and error, in that you die a lot in it because you didn't learn enough about naval warfare for your 14-year-old princess, anime princess. And that turns out to be super important a third of the way through the game when this event happens. So Black Closet is their new game, and it's similar in that it's anime artwork, and it's heavily narrative-driven, but it fixes a bunch of my frustrations with Long Live the Queen in that it's got procedural elements. So the story is that you have just been elected as student council president of this all-girls boarding school, and a teacher explains at the start of the game that the only reason you've been elected is that you come from essentially new money, and therefore... if scandal breaks out under your tenure, then you are an easy scapegoat for that scandal. They can just blame it on you, and it's none of the old families that are famed, that are falling into disrepute. And it's your job as student president to stop those scandals happening. And the way you do that is you've got a staff of anime girls who you can send to perform jobs for you. So you get a case, which is like a box full of textbooks has gone missing. It's one of these four people that have done it. You don't know who. And so you can send one of your girls to search the supply closet to get useful items that might help you in your pursuit. You can send another one off to question one of the suspects. You can send another one off to stalk one of the other suspects. You can send another one off to harass another of the suspects.
And you're serious.
And your little team have different skills based on, they've got social skills, they've got stealth skills, they've got strength, and a fourth one which I can't remember.
Why do you have so many staff? If you're like an investigator in a school, how big is the school?
I guess it's quite a big school, but like, yeah, I guess, you know, if you're in the American schooling system, you would have like a student treasurer and a vice president and stuff like that. And essentially these people are those roles, but you don't really do anything other than try to prevent scandals from happening. And so you send off one of your minions to do those things, and you get a little screen which compares their stats against the stat of the person that they're trying to harass, stalk, or detain. And there's
those are the three verbs.
Those are three of the verbs. There are others. And then there's a little dice roll as well. So there's a little bit of randomness in there. And that determines whether they find out nothing, whether the person breaks down and confesses, or the person gives you another clue and says, that person did it, or I saw that person or something. Or you, sometimes it's too close to call. You get a little bit of information, but not enough to really focus your investigation any further. And you go through the case, and you keep doing this, and you're trying to keep up your reputation and your karma stats, where if they drop below a certain level, you get fired, essentially, and, you know, that's game over. So there is still this fairy state. And you can earn reputation by solving cases quickly, by solving cases without being caught rummaging through a teenage girl's room because you think that they're to blame and maybe they're not, and that sort of stuff. And those things affect your levels. And on the weekends, you've then got more of a simple just choose-your-own-adventure sort of thing where you can choose which of your five staff members to go visit and invite round for tea at the president's office. And they have a kind of a stat for how loyal they are to you, because there's a subplot which involves one of them being a traitor. And you don't know which one it is, but there is one of them who will have a higher percentage chance to fail their investigation tasks. And so you're trying to work out, through your dealings with them on the weekends, as you offer them tea and shortbread, and try and get them to like you. And there's a bunch of romance stuff. You can romance all of them. And you're trying to work out which one of the is the traitor. Because if you don't do that by a certain date, that person is going to probably kill you.
Well, they're a Cylon, so... So are you male?
No, you're female. It's an all-girls school, so it's gay as heck. and so it doesn't have the thing in her story of... It doesn't quite feel like detective work, because the deduction that you're doing isn't your own. You're sending out your minions, and they're doing percentage chances to find a bit of information, and when you find out who did it, because you harassed the correct person and they confess because your strength stat was higher than theirs, that just ends the case, basically. So there is no kind of, you're not piecing together information in your head. But what it does give is quite a satisfying feeling of running a detective agency. Like, you're not a detective yourself, but you feel like you're the head of a police force. You're sending out people to, you know, doorstep people and knock, you know, and get witness accounts, and to question people or to detain people or to, you know, search their premises for clues and stuff like that. So
it seems like such overkill somehow. Like, it's not that it's completely unfeasible that any group of humans would ever care this much about this thing. They might. But it's weird that if you're going to go to the trouble of making a video game with all these mechanics to solve really big, important cases, that you'd pick one that's so trivial.
It's bizarre, like, the social structure of the school, because it's the teachers who have kind of... employed you to do this role, although you were sort of elected by your fellow students, but the teachers don't seem to have any power. So, like, there's a thing of a girl has painted a picture that's going to be revealed in front of all the parents at the school at some sort of parent-teacher conference or something like that, and you have to find out what is the painting of to make sure that it's appropriate. Because if it turns out to be something scandalous, then that would be disastrous. But rather than a teacher just going and saying, hey, can I see your picture that you're doing for the school that you live at? You know, because that's a reasonable request for an adult and an authoritarian to ask. You have to stalk, harass, break into her room in order to get a sight of this picture. And eventually I solved that one by just talking her out of it, because I got a peek of it in her room, and it turned out to be of a baby surrounded by syringes and pills. And I was like, this is wholly inappropriate! And eventually, you know, through my superior social skills of my team, convinced her that, oh yeah, that probably is. I need to go paint something else now.
Thank God, good one out. Art was suppressed.
Why is it called Black Closet?
I don't know. I haven't discovered
that. Because Long Live the Queen is literally what the game is about.
Yeah. Sorry?
Maybe that's where the locket is?
Maybe. But it's really cool, and there's a demo of it which I've played for like 2 hours now, and it still hasn't ended, so that's pretty good. And it's like $15 and satisfying detective management game. And if you can look past the fact that it's a kind of anime visual novel stuff, which comes with lots of shortbread and tea, then it's probably as close as you can get.
In you can wade through all the shortbread and tea to get to the game beneath.
Then it's probably as close as you can get to a kind of police management sim on PC.
Cool.
It's pretty sweet. What have you been playing, Marsh?
I've been playing Deus Ex Human Revolution again.
Also a lot of shortbread and tea in that one.
Oh, there's quite a lot of sugary snacks in it, actually. There are quite a lot of chocolate bars. I don't think they're shortbread. We don't know what what is it called? Pro bar?
I think cyber power.
Adam Jensen deploys his alpha cyber pheromones to find out where the textbooks have been taken.
it's interesting going back to it now and how well it stands up. But I'm doing a video on it for RPS. Should go up at the end of this week. So I don't exactly know what I'm going to say about it now, which wouldn't spoil that video. But it's interesting that the combat isn't quite as glorious as I remember. I remember the combat. I'm really enjoying the combat the first time around.
Like shooting?
Although the consensus on the internet appears to be that was not the case. I just misremembered.
Yeah, I didn't like the shooting. I mean, the intro almost forces you to do it. Yeah. I really hated that.
But the way it works on PC is particularly terrible. Like, the iron sights are bound to, I think, the middle key or something like that, and the right mouse button is to get into cover, which means that you end up kind of not knowing which finger to kind of switch between the keys quite a lot of the time.
I think control-wise it's the same as Rainbow Six Vegas, which I've been playing to death. One of my favourite games, but the reason it's one of my favourite games was because I went back and replayed it after I interviewed the Deus Ex Human Revolution team, and they said, oh yeah, most of us come from Rainbow Six Vegas, and we're just going to do the same control system there. Is that good? I remember that being good. And I went back and played it, became obsessed with it.
The combat's really strange in that it's probably sort of realistic is the wrong word to use for something with elbow chisels in it. But like in terms of the way that difficulty scales with the number of enemies that you fight, it seems quite on par with some kind of sense of reality in that, shooting somebody through the back of the head is way overpowered in that game. Like, everything is kind of pushing you towards just shooting people through the back of the head with a science pistol, one-on-one, because if you use any of your takedown tactics, you're using up energy that could get you out of a scrape later on. And I think the energy system is one of the things that really cripples that game. But as soon as you end up, like, because I've been going through it capturing footage and stuff, I've not been playing it in kind of large chronological bits. I've got one of these, a patch which allows me to swap between different levels in the game. And so when the difficulty scales, I was totally unprepared for it. Like, I've been sneaking through for the first couple of hours, popping people in the back of the head and, you know, elbow chisels and everything. And then as soon as the situation arose where there was like, there's two guys, I could probably take them out, maybe three around the corner who'd hear and come along, I was like, yeah, I can take it, and couldn't. Died almost instantly. And I died over and over again. And I just couldn't get over that, the conceptual difference between attacking one person and the exponential difficulty increase in attacking five people.
Was that with, were you shooting with like an assault rifle or trying to take them out stealthily or?
Assault rifle. Right. In that instance, I wasn't, when you're taking on five people, it's hard to do it stealthily, really.
I don't think I've ever tried it. I played through the first, I played like all of the Detroit, is it? The first section, like about 8 times, because that was all we had access to as journalists for a long time. And then once I got the full game, I played that through like 3-4 times. But I don't think I've ever tried an actual all out violence playthrough. I've tried like,
I vary between
stealthy and non lethal stealthy and total evasion. And
it's certainly not my instinct to do the full out assault. I mean, I think the game encourages you to kill, but not go kind of all out guns blazing.
I don't like the gunny guns, but I do like the pips gun, and I do like the melee combat. Like, there are elements of the combat I like, predominantly those that you can enact through stealth in some way. Although I did do a tried to, like, because I did a no-kill playthrough, and then I decided I would do a genocide playthrough, where I would not just go guns blazing and kill all the enemies, but I would also kill every killable NPC and pedestrian, which I managed in Detroit. I depopulated that level. There are hundreds of defenseless civilians that you have to kill to do that. That was quite fun.
But it was good work. It needed doing.
But yeah.
I do have a question for you guys, though, which is inspired by my playthrough of this. Like, one of the things I'm talking about in the video is the way that power is represented in the game, both through mechanics and kind of the narrative and what it says that power means in the game. I don't think the two things are really in sync with each other in Deus Ex. Although, I think Dishonored would probably, in retrospect, have been a better case study for the video, because that has a much kind of greater power differential in that. The kind of more lethal tactics you use, the kind of more that you use your abilities, the worse that the world gets, you know, and so you're kind of being punished for it and told not to do that stuff. But in Deus Ex, I think in any game, really, where you have, like, I think games are about power to some extent, because they present you with systems that you can master. It's like, that seems like the fundamental aspect of a game is presenting you something that you can get better at and then eventually win at. And that's kind of like a form of power. And in Deus Ex and all these other games, the kind of analogy is played out exactly in the narrative. Like, you appear to get more powerful in those games as you get better at them.
You level up your arms. Yeah. And
but at the same time, those games, I think a lot of games also try and, like, Dishonored is telling you that things are getting worse in the world the more powerful you get. Deus Ex is trying to tell you that maybe you shouldn't, you know, you should actually kind of, Dishonored's worse for this, you know, like, circumvent engaging with this environment in any way in order to be moral, you know, like, you're kind of trying to disempower yourself. The game's telling you that you are disempowered at the same time as you are experiencing this great empowerment through the fact that you've got elbow chisels. And I wonder if games can actually ever really tell a story of disempowerment, whether that has ever happened in games, because they're all about systems and they're all about bettering yourself in some way.
I remember someone telling me about an indie game recently where things get locked off, you get worse and worse as you play. And it was always my, like, dream for a Hitman game, where instead of unlockable weapons, you started with a full arsenal and they got locked off with each new level. And so you'd be doing jobs that are all set around a city, and initially you're not even in the city, just in the surrounding area, and so it's just pure lawless countryside, and so there's no restrictions on what weapons you can use. You can use rocket launchers and fucking tanks or whatever. And then as you get closer to the city, there's more and more, like, police presence, and they have harsher and harsher restrictions on weapons. And then in the inner city, like, no guns are allowed. You're searched every checkpoint, and so you get in with just your bare hands, and, like, the final target to take out completely unarmed, because for the same reason, because I wanted it to match. I thought, if you're getting better at the game, then the game shouldn't also be giving you more help. It should be giving less and less help. But
I wonder if can you tell a story of actual, like, not even getting better at something? Like, can you tell
you're
a
also shit. Well,
because one of the things about the whole Deus Ex furore following the mechanical apartheid announcement, sorry, that's a strange phrase to use. At E3, they said that the...
Bad news, guys. I know you've come here to see some video games, but actually half of you are going to have to...
So at E3 they mentioned that there's a sequel to Deus Ex, as you may have heard, and part of the theme of that is that the cyborgs in the world of Deus Ex are now the downtrodden people. They're being persecuted and chased out of cities because they have mechanical arms and shit, yeah. Which is exactly like racism. And, can you really do that in a game? Can you tell a story about racism in which you are disempowered?
He's still super powerful international mega agent who's not only empowered by being an authority figure, he works for Interpol, but also has a secondary power where he's also secretly working for a different organization to even have power over Interpol themselves. I think he's going to be massively empowered again.
I feel it's some way like this much more closely mimics real life, where my actions although they might benefit me or make me more powerful, do not noticeably cause rats to appear in more street corners or for my features
You've
to
never
become...
shot a flat man.
or for my features to become more devil-like and hunched and horrible. And so in some ways, like, you know, Deus Ex can simulate the experience of white guilt. You know, it's he can't actually change anything, and he's stuck with all his power and his entitlement, and all you can choose is whether you say, yeah, this is fucking awesome, or whether you say, oh, I didn't ask for this. I feel dead bad about it and everything.
The famous second line. I feel dead bad. Ain't right.
No, but the idea is, at least in the second game, and to some extent in the first game as well, you know, his self-pity and, oh, I didn't ask for this, and everybody fucking hates Adam Jensen anyway in the first game. In the second game, the entire world hates cyborgs, and the idea is that they're actually now becoming a dispossessed people. But that's never going to be expressed through the game, because you're always going to experience the agency in that world via Adam Jensen, who is a fucking amazing cyborg. You want to be, and I don't think can you ever have a game where you play as a 14-year-old black girl having her head stabbed on by a cop? You know, like can that
not for long?
Because that expression of disempowerment can never really be expressed through a system in which you achieve mastery.
Surely. I interviewed BioWare about exactly this in relation to Dragon Age, because Dragon Age is a lot about prejudice. Like the stories that, you know, their kind of reconfiguring of a fantasy world for that series was a lot about. Sort of, you know, adding a social or class dimension to things that, well, as in social class, to things that were traditionally character class related. So the kind of persecution of mages in the Dragon Age universe, where it's, you know, it borders on a comment on, you know, it's a closer and better analogy for forms of discrimination in the real world than augmentation is in the Deus Ex universe, because the notion in the Dragon Age universe is that some people are born mages. And when they're discovered as mages, it causes this sort of socio-political problem around them until someone has to deal with it. And every different civilization in that world has a different response to it. Also, elves are...
But are these narrative attempts,
this is the thing.
Or are they mechanically
so, mirrored? This is so, just to get this point. So the story absolutely makes it clear that, you know, mages and elves, particularly the two things you can be as a player, that have... quite severe social ramifications, and large plots of the game revolve around persecution of one or the other or both. However, the player character in Dragon Age games is very rarely seriously inconvenienced by it, regardless of who they are. So you can be an elf mage in Dragon Age Origins, and they get you out of it by having you be recruited into this sort of supranational organization that is exempt from all that stuff. And you get it in some sort of, like, flavor text in terms of, like, I don't trust you because of this, that, and the other, but you never really suffer for it. Dragon Age 2 suffers from it really badly, where you can play as a mage and be just doing wizard things in the middle of the street in a story that is ostensibly about the persecution of mages and the fact that you are undercover, that you're having to, like, save up money and scrounge to protect your family from the fact that you are a mage or a family member is a mage, whereas you're just in the street wearing a dress and a pointy hat with a stick. And Dragon Age Inquisition, again, you can be any of those things, but in the main plot, you find yourself elevated above the rest of humanity anyway. And it does better, it's better at it, because it introduces, you know, it'll have characters, refer to you differently. And some of it's genuinely really well written, but it never has that mechanical impact. And I was talking to them about this, like, you know, why is this, because this stuff is, it's not like it's, in the case of Deus Ex, it's a sorry decision, but it doesn't feel as absolutely core to an entire series as it is to Dragon Age, whereas in every single game, very, very prominently, and yet always, opting to play as the elf or opting to play as the mage doesn't result in some kind of restriction on your character or your mechanical development. And Patrick Weeks, who is the lead narrative, lead writer on Dragon Age generally, said that in his years of writing Dungeons & Dragons supplements and all the rest of that stuff, the response to doing that has been so bad that it's not viable in a commercial product.
Wow.
Like, they've tried it. Obviously, these are creative people who have these ideas, and you try it, and the response is so bad that it's like torpedoes the project, which is interesting because, and part of the notion is that, you know, you basically punish, people might, this might be their first, Dragon Age Inquisition might be their first encounter with that fiction. And they want to be a cool elf, and they don't realize that the decision they make in character creation is putting them in a social class where they'll be persecuted.
Yeah.
At which point, you've got a really good analogy for being discriminated against something you didn't choose, that you had with you from birth. But the fact is that the response is so bad that because players have the option, for example, of re-rolling their character, that the moment you put their resistance in the way, that you can always tell these stories, but you can't really ever put the player character in them. The player character should always be this sort of neutral cipher, even if you give them some other way around it. Like, the bit where DAI is, I think, successful, there's a really good bit where I played as an elf, and you are this messianic figure that, you know, your legend spreads to other people, and people talk about who you are and who you might be, and you can choose to downplay or play up the sort of religious connotations that come with your role, and, you know, embrace the kind of the following you get, or be like, look, I don't believe in this stuff, please don't call me the second coming. But some of the more traditional people you meet have a real problem with the fact you're an elf, and there's a, you know, great conversation with a very gruff character who's like, he's like, I just didn't think, and you can kind of cut him off, you didn't think I would be an elf, did you? And he's just like, no, I didn't. And so it does kind of interesting depth things with how racism can manifest in ways where it's sort of not even a kind of oblique, you know, it's not necessarily a in-your-face persecution thing, but just this subtle interaction with everything you do. But it can never do the you get paid half as much because you're a mage thing.
See, I think all these kind of efforts to introduce these sort of analogies to racism in games are a good thing. Like, I they obviously come from a good place on the part of the developers. They're trying to, you know, smuggle empathy into their game, you know, trying to get their audience to understand what it might be like to be oppressed, whilst at the same time luring them in with the promise of empowerment. And I think that's a good thing. I think maybe it engages people with issues that they would never have otherwise connected with. But I actually think when you get, like, characters like Adam Jensen, who are obviously incredibly powerful, or even characters like, you know, Batman or Wolverine or all these other characters who are tortured, but obviously really powerful. We talked about last week or the week before, how the X-Men is also an analogy to racism in the persecution of mutants.
Mm.
I think actually it has the exact opposite effect, perhaps, of the one that's desired, in that it doesn't really teach you empathy with the genuinely oppressed, but it gives people who have power another excuse to feel sorry for themselves. Like, there's nothing more alluring than figures like Batman and other kind of tortured superheroes, because they have power, and yet by virtue of their apparent suffering, they have then deserved it.
Mm.
And there's nothing better than deserving power, is there?
They have the luxury of brooding.
Yeah, and everybody, you know, I think instead of teaching empathy, I think what it does is it teaches you ways to seek ways in which you can reinterpret a reality so you appear to be the abused party. No. Yeah. So, yeah.
Essentially, can a fun game about robots
be awful? No, I don't think it is. I think, I still think that these things are valuable to, I mean, even though I think they're problematic, I think it's worth having problems in order to explore these things, and it's worth trying.
Hmm.
I think they come from good places.
Shall we do questions from questions?
Okay.
Correct.
Good. Agreed. Andrew writes, Dear Crate and Cronin the Barbarian, as you all, I think, at some point worked for or do work for PC Gamer, can you please enlighten me as to who does the captions for the screenshots? Is it the person who penned the accompanying article, or is it a last thing on a Friday job nobody wants when there's not much else to do? Sorry this isn't a deep breaching question of game mechanics and their relationship to narrative, but it's the kind of minutia that drives me insane not knowing. Little narrative dissonance. Andrew.
So, it's usually the writer.
It's meant to be the writer.
Yeah.
If it's a shitty freelancer, then poor old Tony Ellis has to do it.
Yeah.
The long-standing, excellent sub-editor of PC Gamer.
Indeed.
And hero to us all.
Often writes very funny things for which the writer always gets credit.
Yes, he's made many of my articles actually worth reading.
The unsung hero, for sure.
The only time I didn't do them for my own articles was sometimes when, if it was like a big review, I would submit like 200 screenshots, because I feel like the art people should pick what screenshots look best on the page and how they're going to lay them out. And then I don't want to write 200 captions if only 8 of them are going to be used. So then I do afterwards.
But yeah, then in that case, it's still the writer that does it. So yeah, vast majority of the time, it's the writer who wrote the article. If not them, then it's probably Tony Ellis. Or me or Sam. At present.
I miss writing captions sometimes. There's something satisfying about trying to come
it's
up
really
with a
best part of the magazine.
Five to eight words kind of joke related to something.
Well, that's the thing. I think I want to write a caption for it. I get excited about it. And then I realize my caption's 12 words long, which seems super short. That seems like being so fucking pithy. Like, Twitter's got nothing on that. This is 12 words and it works. And 12 words way too long.
It's going to be like long running.
3 words.
Long running issue with the fact that driving games are impossible to fucking caption. Like, banned ourselves many years ago from just writing some cars yesterday on every single picture of a driving game.
I think even I have written those exact words. Yeah, exactly.
I think at some point I did a 20-page booklet on World of Tanks that just had on every page...
Only 20
like,
pages.
Like 8 screenshots of tanks. But I loved it. It was great because you start to humanise the tanks. There's a kind of stoicism to this tank sat
on a
grassy hillside staring serenely off to the middle distance to some unseen horizon. What are you dreaming of, little tank? I would type into the caption box.
Oh, this isn't one-upmanship, but I had to do that for a 164-page book about World of Warplanes. And, yeah, you go to some strange places with those.
You can get away with what you do on RPS, Marsh. I would say those are too long for a magazine caption.
Today's was particularly fine. I liked the yogurt reference.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, what does murder have to do with yogurt and
Find
trains?
Out.
Find out on Monday. That's fun.
The Monday prior to when this podcast goes up. So find out right now if you really want to.
Monday prior, is it?
Yeah, because it goes up today, and this podcast goes up this Friday. So
it doesn't go up today.
Well, that's time.
This is Monday.
It's Monday today.
Oh yeah, you're right. Sorry, I thought we were recording this on Tuesday.
What article is this?
Premature Evaluations, Look at the Game Train Valley, written by Marsh Davies on rockpapershotgun.com.
We'll be in the show notes.
World's best website for PC games. I'm just playing. Kane writes, to whom it may concern.
Not even writing to that. Do what you like.
What do you famously fine folks think of asynchronous games? I'm talking about games like Neptune's Pride, which are designed to run constantly in the background, whether the user is actively engaged with them or not, where events happen on their own schedule, outside of the player's direct control. I was thinking about this style of design for a game I was working on a few years ago, and had hoped to see developers start exploring it in some depth. Despite the increasing prevalence of tools that make it easier to implement, though, like HTML5, cheap cloud computing services, and mobile devices, it's still mostly used in a really limited fashion. Most asynchronous games fall into two categories, games like Nico et Sum or Mountain, where the events that happen aren't tied to any particular systemic or narrative continuity. They're basically just elaborate digital aquariums, and games that use energy bar mechanics, like The Last Court, which use asynchrony to slow the experience down for free players to skeezily push them towards microtransactions. I think asynchronous games has a lot more potential for simulation games. Sims, like The Sims, Dwarf Fortress, and City Builders have to engage in weird time distortion in order to ensure that events happen with regular enough frequency to keep players engaged. Dwarves only need to eat once or twice a month. It takes 10 minutes for a sprightly young Sim to descend a small staircase, and in City Skylines, a child will wait 3 weeks for the school bus to arrive before deciding to spend another month walking to school. What if instead Dwarf Fortress ran constantly in the background, and every action took a realistic amount of time? Dwarfs have to eat 2 or 3 times a day, spend 6 to 10 hours sleeping, depending on age and personality traits, and can expertly butcher a cat in 3 minutes. You could have time running at 7 times speed, but you'd be able to use the same time compression factor for everything. Designing a sim this way could allow you to accommodate elements on much more disparate scales of time and size without distorting their relative importance, especially when combined with tools to automate smaller scale tasks when the progression of your game starts requiring you to focus on larger scale ones. What do you think about asynchronous game design? Do you think there's unexplored potential in it? The Riest of Guards. Kane.
It always makes me think of... I mean, Neptune's Pride was a dark time in my life. I don't want to ever go back to it. Like, I've literally... This is not so much to do with the asynchronicity. It's a little bit to do with the asynchronicity, but I kind of swore never to play a game like that ever again. And partly because it was destroying real friendships, but also because the asynchronous element was kind of unwelcome. Like, I don't... Sort of anything you do like that you either have to let it be something that can be positive or negative, like time is flowing when you're not playing it, and so something bad could happen if you don't play it, and then that sucks for me because it might be 4 a.m. or I just don't have time to play that particular game, or, you know, something else is happening. And I think probably almost everybody has some kind of constraints on their time, and you're never going to get the game, I don't know, maybe this is wrong, but it would be difficult to get the game to always match your schedule, you know, so that it never required something unreasonable of you at an unreasonable hour. Or you can do it in a way that the asynchronous part is always positive. So EVE Online, I mean, this is actually still a negative aspect of it, but EVE Online, you train skills, and they take a certain amount of real time to train. And you don't have to be there, you don't have to play it, you don't have to do anything at all. This skill just takes, you want to learn interceptor piloting, that's just going to take 4 days. And it just, as long as you don't change what skill you're learning, it will happen in 4 days regardless of what you do. And so you can't kind of lose that way, but actually you can lose by not logging in when it finishes, because if the time that it finishes, you don't log in to change and train something new, then your character is just idle and they don't learn anything at all. Probably, I mean, this was like 10 years ago, so maybe they've added the ability to queue skills, I don't know. But yeah, it's, and then if it's universally positive at all, I suppose that's not a bad system necessarily. But the thing that does interest me about it is this idea of like giving things their correct relative importance, their relative scale. And I'd love, the one thing that appeals to me about it is the idea of like traveling. I'd love a game where like you can go anywhere, but if you want to cross the world, it's going to take literally 3 weeks. And I don't know how that works, because I don't know, can you play it in between, and how do you play it in between? But maybe even something like 80 days, that took 80 days.
Yeah, it would have been a very different game if it had been, for example, a mobile thing that buzzed you when it was like, hey, you've arrived, what do you want to do in Calcutta for the next 4 hours? Like, that would be kind of quite pleasant, really. And then, you know, it would take, literally, you'd finish your run in 49 days and you'd be talking to mates who are still halfway around the world.
You could even get, like, a buff for it if it detects via your GPS that you're travelling in the same direction your character is. So if you're taking a flight to the US, you plan your route to kind of be going west as well.
There's two things to this, and I've actually spoken explicitly about this as regards Dwarf Fortress on the podcast, about wanting it to be that kind of asynchronous thing. And one is that I always really like the idea of an ant farm, this thing which is just in the corner of your room fiddling away, and you wake up in the morning and you go look at it and go, oh, they're starting to dig a new tunnel. And that is just a little 15-second little experience or interaction with that world, but is still compelling over a long course of time. It requires very little of you, but just observing creatures living out their lives and observing them, there's a satisfaction in that. The other thing is, and we've talked about this in the podcast as relates to, for example, DayZ or Star Wars Galaxies, is I think boredom and tedium aren't always terrible things, or at the very least, they don't only have negative consequences. They can also lend great power to when there is suddenly a moment where a thing happens. And, you know, I think Kane's slightly naive if he thinks that Neptune's Pride is just happening when you're not looking at it, because if you're playing that game, you're always looking at it and always thinking of it. And
or someone like, is.
Yeah. Oh, we played, there's a DEFCON mode where you can basically put it into real time, and we thought, oh, we'll play this, it'd be great. We can play it in the background at work during the day, and still do our normal work day, but have this going on in the background,
because it takes about, like, about it. Like a few hours for an intercontinental ballistic missile to reach its target, so unfolds in the course of like an 8-hour day. Pretty neat.
Yeah, but no work got done that day. Yeah. We just spent all our time rubbing our temples, staring at icons moving very slowly across the screen, because you can't look away. There's a nuclear missile. It's moving somewhere. Where is it going?
And anyone could launch anything at any time. You know, you've got to keep checking it to see, make sure nothing's changed since you last checked it. Even though what you did won't have completed, someone else might have done something.
Whereas I feel like, you know, if you were to design a game specifically around this idea, you could solve some of these problems, or it would certainly be interesting to try. And I think, you know, like Neptune's Pride, where it's competitive, that's kind of tricky, same with DEFCON, but something like a city builder, like Cities Skylines, there's not that much negative stuff that can happen in that anyway. Like, you can go bankrupt, but that's not the kind of thing that's just going to happen overnight, unless you went to bed and you had zero money and you could see that there were huge expenses coming in. Like, that was unlikely to take you by surprise. And yeah, you might get some traffic problems, but, well, you know, like, mayors still sleep in the real world and stuff like that. That's not a life or death situation. What? That, oh, now my entire city is fucked, it's ruined, I have to start over all over again. It's like, no, that's just the nature of the thing. And so I would love for a city builder game, or Dwarf Fortress, which does have things that can go seriously wrong, but has AI dwarves, which are more autonomous and better able to deal with their situations. So you could still, you know, set up your fort and your dwarves in such a way that they were able to deal with most scenarios well enough that even if you got up and there had been some sort of terrible disaster involving a fire demon or stampeding elephants or something like that, that your fort would still have survived enough that it would be interesting to continue playing at that point. So, so yes, I would love for people to do this.
The Fallout game, the mobile game that they announced at
Shelter,
yeah, is apparently asynchronous, like, kind of goes on in the background.
It sort of does. I deleted it. I don't find it particularly gratifying. It's very much a sort of tiny tower. Is it Tiny Tower?
Tiny Tower.
Yeah, ish, and it's kind of... Stuff progresses when you're not playing, but also like the needs rack up in a really unsatisfying way. Like because it has those sort of like very pop cappy tap mechanics where like you don't get the food from your cafe unless you tap it. That means you can be in the red on food, but it's just because you haven't been around to tap the button that collects the food, which is not in the same territory Graham's talking about, where it's like these people are starving to death. They're not gonna wait for God to shake the food out of the cafe for them, you know what I mean? Like make any sense. I didn't find it particularly compelling, honestly, but
one of the reasons I want this is because I want games to bleed out into the real world a little bit more. The thing I think you just mentioned, Chris, about getting a text message from a game to tell you that something had happened. Like, a City Skyline, it's got...
Twitter.
Yeah, that crappy little bird that everyone hates at the top. But if that was an actual Twitter account that was reporting in real time the tweets of fake citizens living in your actual city, and that was just rolled into your regular Twitter account about your ongoing asynchronous world. Would be quite a cool
ruinous to your product,
perhaps. But like I say, in City Skylines, there aren't any problems that require your immediate attention.
Right.
So getting a little tweet from a fake citizen of your fake city that says, I'm really fucking sick of this traffic jam I'm stuck in at 8 in the morning when you're also commuting to your actual job. That would just be a nice little thing about, you know, this pet world that you've got at home.
I'm sure
you should do that, but sign them all up to follow Boris Johnson.
That would be brilliant. Amy writes, Dear Creighton Crowbar, there have been a great deal of postmortems following the closure/downscaling of Tale of Tales a few weeks ago, but aside from the various questions of how exactly Sunset failed, there have also been some discussion about how Tale of Tales had been funded in the past through arts grants. Some people have been very dismissive of the idea that any game without significant commercial potential deserves to be funded by quote-unquote handouts. But I think that the kind of odd, difficult, and experimental games with very limited audience appeal, the kind Tale of Tales produced before Sunset, are very important. During my own education in illustration, one of the things we were taught was the idea that, quote, fine art today is designed in 20 years, end quote. I believe this is true, and that a similar creative trickle-down effect applies to most media, games included. Would you agree, and how do you think fringe/art/experimental game design should be financially supported, or if it should be financially supported at all? Cheers, sorry for the length, and keep up the fine podcasting. Amy. From the number of designers of mainstream games that have come out over the past 2 weeks and said, we were inspired in some way by the path, by the graveyard, by any of a number of Tale of Tales games, I can totally see her point that there is value in art which is not commercially viable, only for the sake of that art itself, but for the strength of the medium in general and for the way it creatively trickles down to the rest of the industry.
I'm not quite sure who the people are who are saying that art grants shouldn't exist. That seems like a completely bizarre position to take.
Cliff Harris. Positech Games wrote a post in the wake of Tale of Tales to say that he does not believe that arts funding should exist. From his point, it was that there is always something that he believes is more worthwhile to spend your money on. And in an age of austerity, he believes that money spent funding art or games is money not spent helping the homeless or the starving or the ill or the decrepit and so forth.
Well, if you're going to... Well, yeah, but I mean, you could take any kind of expenditure and put it against helping the homeless or helping the ill and make it sound pretty bad.
Yeah,
I don't think...
is what he did.
Yeah, exactly. But it's kind of like a bit of kind of rhetorical cheapness, isn't it, really? I mean...
I don't think it's rhetorical. I think it's a real choice. It's money. It all works.
Yeah, but I mean...
You did put it towards homelessness.
Yeah, but money goes everywhere. Like, I mean, it's not just always going to go towards...
Maybe it shouldn't. Maybe it should all go literally straight to the homeless.
Yeah, I don't think that's realistic. I mean, in the same way, it's kind of the same symptom of when somebody rocks up in the comments when you're talking about a particular game, and they say, "Why are you talking about this? Why don't you talk about this much more important thing?" And like, well, you know, there's lots of space for all kinds of different things to exist.
It seems like it's different with money, though, where money is more finite than words are, you know.
There's a really good article recently about a sort of, I don't know if it's a school of thought or a subject or a philosophy called effective altruism, which is about essentially if you're, the example they give is if you're like a well-educated numerate college student and you're just going out to the world and you want to do some good, your instinct might be to take a job at Oxfam and help out on a kind of personal basis. But if you went and got a job at Wall Street and earned an absurd salary and then just started giving, like, you know, 70% of that salary to charity, which you could easily afford to do, you'd do far more good, in part because that's something that not everyone can do, and that, you know, it's all money, and money should be put to the best possible purpose.
Yeah, but to the point in question, like, I mean, surely grants for art games aren't the same as taking a job at Oxfam.
No.
Right. I don't know.
It's worth thinking.
Society benefits from lots of different things in lots of different ways. It can't. Mm. I mean, obviously, you have to choose how much of society pays directly towards the benefit of individuals, or kind of, you know, pays for infrastructure and stuff like that. But obviously, there is obviously a kind of benefit to funding cultural endeavours that don't have any kind of immediate economic.
Like, I agree with you, but a lot of people don't, is the thing. And, you know, Europe is better for it, but the UK is worse than most of the rest of Europe, and America is much worse still. Like, America has very little arts funding, and it's a constant source of debate of whether there should be any arts funding whatsoever. So, I agree with you, but it is an issue of debate. I don't think it's...
It's interesting, because, I mean, you know, art is traditionally commercially viable. Like, you know, it's the further back you go, the harder it becomes to find, because of the way that the preservation of classical art works, pretty much. I mean, if you go back to antiquity, then it's not quite that. But
and when you say commercially viable, you're talking about people being patronized,
patronized
even.
But you know,
but that's the same thing as being given a grant. It's just
it's a commercial transaction. Like, it's not the same as, well, is it?
Yeah, you know,
you still
what I mean?
Have to make something that appeals to an audience, that belongs to a trend, whether that's religious portraiture or something like that. You're still making something to order in that sense. It seems far closer to commercialized art than it does to grant-supported artistic freedom, which is not the same as patronage.
Yeah, I think there's a fundamental difference between money that goes from someone who chose to give it to an artist to produce something, and money that came from taxes, which the individual people did not choose to give to any particular destination. So, like, I mean, Jason Rohrer has a patron, right? He's paid to make games by some, I don't think we know who it is, like some mysterious wealthy person just pays him. I don't know if that's still the case, but it was when he was making that home invasion thing.
Castle Doctrine.
I'm
not saying that is the definition of what art is, or the things that aren't commercially viable should pull themselves up, but the two are linked in a way that, you know, to say that art has always had this sanctity of commercial independence is, I think, completely false.
Yeah.
I would say, though, that, like, I absolutely believe arts funding should exist, but I think games haven't really replicated a lot of the other ways that art has found ways to survive and make that funding efficient. you know, what it has, but not to the same scale of something like galleries and festivals and so on. These tend to be the ways that, like, I can only speak from experience in fringe theatre, but fringe theatre does not survive in isolation. It never does. It's never commercially viable. Individual shows never live. Festivals of lots of different projects all brought together with funding distributed in whatever way, where, you know, they create a big pot to put an audience, an aggregate audience in, then slosh that audience around between lots of different shows, is how that sort of thing survived in the era where the only commercially viable theatre is Big West End stuff. That's how it happened. And it, because it was never going to happen. Like, no amount of funding was ever going to make it worth it financially to support one-off, isolated art theatre performances. And I think the same is true of games. Like, I think it's true of art in general, because art, and one of the other things that more or less, if not defines it, then comes with the territory, is small audiences, which is where the roots of this commercial struggle thing comes from. But if you're talking about small audiences, then you have to find a way and your revenue and the viability of the thing is always going to be linked to having bigger audiences. But the thing you create by necessity needs to have a small audience. They need to solve that problem somehow. And it usually means, I think, artists working either together or curators coming on to bring things together that help kind of in a cooperative sense create a bigger audience for the stuff that exists. It doesn't surprise me at all that a studio going itself can't make that viable, because literally it hasn't happened in any other medium.
Mm.
So there should be funding, absolutely. But there should also be structures in place for art to exist and be found en masse by the audience that actually wants it, rather than rolling art out onto the Steam store where it's not going to survive, because it just simply isn't.
It's interesting because I keep wanting to say Patreon, and I think it is relevant to this, and that's a new thing that gives more ways for people who have some money to support artists who will not make that money from what they sell. Like Alan Hazelden is producing free games backed by his Patreon, or at least was. I don't know if that's still going on. And I keep thinking Kickstarter, which is kind of... Because my instinct is like, if Sunset helped so many of these influential people who've made incredibly successful games, you know, if it formed that for them, then they have money. They should be giving money to these people. I think they probably are, because both of the Sunset founders have Patreons now, and they've heavily publicized that fact, since loads of people want to help them out. But also, like Kickstarter, they did use Kickstarter. That's a thing that already exists for people to get funding for a thing from a smaller number of people who might be willing to pay more. Like, you can pay the bare minimum Kickstarter, but a decent chunk of the money comes from the people who pay the $5,000 rewards and the ridiculous ones. And it seems like quite a good system for that. But Sunset had a Kickstarter, and it was successful, and they made the game, and then the game itself wasn't. So it's obviously not... I don't know. It's not a perfect system, but maybe that's just because the finances of it didn't balance out. I mean, if the amount they asked for on Kickstarter was all they needed to make the game and break even, then the fact that it sold another I can't remember now. I shouldn't say if I can't remember. But some proportion of their 4,000 sales were after their launch, and if the Kickstarter had been enough to fund their entire development, then all of that would have been pure profit, and they would be, you know, in a better state.
Yeah. I do feel like... What?
Sorry. Carry on. You just seem extraordinarily drunk there for like half a second. I'm sure you're not. It's just that...
The system works better than people are giving it credit for in the wake of the Tale of Tales thing. You know, fundamentally, Tale of Tales have made, 8 games? And they were able to make their most ambitious game yet and release it. Like, the system does not need to guarantee that all things be successful and that all companies are able to continue making things in perpetuity. Like,
if you plan your entire business strategy on using art grants forever to carry on making games, then I think you're probably foolish. But, like, the idea of art grants existing as a thing doesn't seem to be, like, I don't understand why that would be bad.
Think of the homeless people, man. Think of the homeless people. They can't eat pictures.
Malaria. That's where it should all be going to.
Malaria.
Yeah. Incredibly widespread, incredibly fatal and incredibly cheap to... You'd think with that amount of money, but no. It turns out you can throw a hell of a lot of money at malaria and still...
But nobody knows what to do with it.
Desperately needs
more. You can kill mosquitoes, but they come back.
Yeah, if we could wipe out mosquitoes, that'd be good.
Well, yeah. There, I mean, that's what Bill Gates has posited as a possible solution, is to actually have a complete xenocide, essentially.
Almost. Xenocide? Is that
yeah, that's a complete annihilation of species.
Wow, that's a cool word. I can't believe there's not already a video game about this.
It's an awesome...
Bill Gates'
His return to Microsoft. Xbox exclusive shooter.
Zach Forrest writes, writing on the Twitters... His question is, pitch a Ubisoft-style iconic item of clothing for inclusion in their next wanky open-world adventure.
It's tough to do this quickly enough that they haven't already done it, because like I was thinking, okay, what's their next game? Oh, Syndicate. Oh, they've already announced the iconic thing for that. It's the cane sword, and you fucking get a free cape... Well, not a free cane sword, but you get a cane sword with the ridiculous edition.
You can pre-order it now.
What's the Divisions? So, an iconic beanie hat of some kind.
A little robot turret with twitching legs.
The mini turret.
were the legs twitching because it was a glitch in that video? Or was it just really, really cute?
I was... I don't know what I thought, but I started thinking it was a glitch when I mocked it on Twitter, and then the Division official account replied to me and said, well spotted, the mini turret holds its ground, so you don't have to.
With its rattly little adorable tiny legs. Now, the Division will be like some sort of fucking... ironic Christmas hat that you wear sadly.
Wear this sadly.
Yeah. And just remember, oh, isn't this Christmas terrible? You'll think, gunning down your friends for their loot in a really ill-conceived game design decision.
I would like somebody to release a range of kind of amiibo-style vinyl figures, but for CEOs of major video game companies.
Wouldn't it be cute to have an amazing
Yves Gemmo?
Exactly. Yves Gemmo, you can mount him on top of the shoulders of Tyler, Aisha Tyler. It'd be great.
To combine their powers.
So you're arguing for the iconic tie-in...
Yeah, the stackable...
Eve Gemmo minifig.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know which game that would tie into, but probably all of them, hopefully.
Rainbow Six Siege should have a... The collector's edition should come with a sledgehammer. The character Sledge has.
Iconic sledgehammer.
For destroying barbed wire. Which is a thing you can do with a sledgehammer, apparently.
Ghost.
Well, actually, don't the drones used to scout as the counter-terrorists. I'd seen that from like, the drone's perspective, but in the E3 thing, I saw the drone itself, and it's, like, super cute. It's absolutely tiny, and it's just like a little rolling cylinder, basically.
Yeah. Hmm. You can say Ghost.
I was going to say the Ghost
iconic
Recon
ghost.
Wildlife. Yep. The, like, yeah, the iconic sheet you wear over your head. Put two holes in it.
And go, shh.
With binoculars for Recon.
Yeah, no, they have no fucking Far Cry iconic gap year pashmina.
It'll be like iconic shades next, I think, for Far Cry.
Mm.
Iconic tribal tattoo.
Iconic malaria. Sure.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Oh, God, Tyson. They do like an iconic mosquito net. Like, when you buy that edition, you get like a sort of novelty mosquito net to wrap over yourself while you play the game, but also it pays for like 100 mosquito nets for people in the Congo. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, they should do that.
And I have no other ideas.
Yeah, no. But we've saved Ubisoft now.
Thank God, someone needed to.
And that's all the time for questions we have.
If you'd like to send us a question, you can email us at questions@CreightonCrowbar.com. You can also tweet us at CreightonCrowbar. You can leave a question on the forum at CreightonCrowbar.com/forum. Or, if you don't want to really leave us a question, but would rather follow us and find out what we think about other miscellaneous things, you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at C Thurston, that's CTHURSTEN, Marsh.
I'm at Marsh Davis, that's DAVIES.
Graham.
I'm at Gunnas, GONNAS.
Tom.
And I'm at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
Thank you for listening, everyone.